Continuation of an oral history interview with Russell Fidget. Today is the 20th of January 2006, and this will be tape number MPFH42, side A. Right. You said that most of the people at Millers Point worked for the Maritime Services Board or had some related sort of work. What did the mothers do mainly?
The mums, very few of my friends' mums worked. Russell Taylor's mum worked in Farmers, the old Farmers shop, which is now David Jones, I think, and she was behind the counter. My mum was at home. I don't remember many people's mums working, unless they worked in a shop at the point, like one of the little shops or something. That was part of the fact that they were living in the house and the shop was there and they were on call, like they could walk out from, well, not even watching TV, but, you know, listen to the radio or doing something housework, and they could walk out and serve in the shop. But I don't remember many of them. All the mothers were, there was a little playground called the Lance Kindergarten. It's at the bottom of High Street in Millers Point. It was a council run, I think, or council funded. And most of us kids, or kids of my generation, it's still working as a child mining centre at the moment. But a lot of the mums used to go down there to give them a hand, to look after the kids and things like that. And it was only for kids preschool, like up to 5 years old, I suppose. And that's, I don't remember very many people's mums working. And as I said, but mostly the dad was the breadwinner and the mum was the homebody or whatever. And I think that was just sort of the way it was in those times.
And talking about schooling, what was your path of schooling? Where did you start off?
I went to, in whilst I was living at Millers Point, I went to kindergarten and first class at Fort Street Primary School, which is next to where the Carl Expressway disappears under the Harbour Bridge there. Most of the kids that I grew up with, because when we shifted out of the area, I'd do my schooling at where we were living, and then every sort of a weekend come in and stay at my grandmother's and spend all the time I could at Millers Point, because that was where all my friends were. The people, I was only saying that the people that I went to school with at Parramatta and places like that, I can't remember their names. I have very few names I can remember, whereas I can remember nearly all the kids' names from the Millers Point area.
What was the school like at Millers Point, the Fort Street school that you went to?
It was just a state government school. It had the normal six classes. It was a modern building. I think it was built in the 50s. I could be wrong. I remember the oleanders. There was oleanders everywhere, which they found out later were poisonous to kids. And we were always playing with the seed pods on, which was the poisonous part. But it was basically an inner city school with cement playgrounds, or there was a little bit of grass, not much, and tarred thing. I always remember a big incinerator at the back, an industrial incinerator that used to be burning most days at school. You'd go up there and there was a fire going on. But I only spent a very short period of time at the school there. But most of the people in my age, they done all their primary school there, then went off to either Roselle High School, or some went to actually Fourth Street High and things like that.
The school now is down to about 45 students. It's marginal at the moment. How many were there in your day?
I think there was. I have old photos at home of school pageants and things there, of fancy dress balls and things with just my class. And I think there was over 30 odd kids in my class. I can remember an outing that I think it was 1954 Easter show, that all the mums, and there's probably 10 or 15 mothers in this photo at the back of the whole class, which was the kindergarten class at the time, all at the Easter show. And I mean, can you imagine what pandemonium it was it's really well attended now, but the Easter show was a very big event. And as kids, you'd always try and save up or get some money together so you could go to the Easter show every year. And we'd, all the kids of our group, get on the bus down at Circle Quay and go out, this is when the buses start, out to the showground and that, and then just first thing we do is go in straight in and go to the boxing tent to watch Jimmy Sharman's boxes. I always remember that. But it was a big event, and the ladies, I think the ladies at the time, because they weren't working, were more involved with the looking after and like PNC type things. So that's.
What about the church? Did a lot of people help the church?
I know the Garrison Church. My grandmother was very involved in it. The Garrison's a church, of England Church. My mother and father were married in it. My sister was, both me and my sister were christened in it, and my sister was later married in it. And we used to go down. They used to have a thing called SEBS, which was Church of England Boys Brigade. And it was like they had a little uniform, you could join that. I can remember in what is a museum there now in the Garrison Yards, that was where the Sunday schools were always held. And my grandmother used to take me down there because I was in there every weekend, and it was part of the thing that I had to do. I was obliged to go. When she went to church, I went to the Sunday school until she came out of church, and she used to do the go down every Saturday afternoon. And if I had nothing to do, I'd go down and help her polish the brass in there. She was very good in that respect, and she used to do the flower arrangements. Someone donated the flowers, and she'd do the arrangements for the main church meeting of the week, which of course was the Sunday. And I always remember going down, there was this massive brass eagle, like a lectern, and it stood there, and that was my favourite bit, if I could polish that. And I think it's still there, in actual fact. I think it's still in the church itself.
Right. How far do people usually go with their education at Millers Point?
Most people that I know of went at the time because there was when you went to high school, there was 3 years of high school, and then there was a level called the intermediate certificate, and then if you wanted to go to tertiary education, like university and that, you had to go to fifth year, which was to get a leaving certificate. And very few of the friends that I grew up with went past intermediate certificate. I think Russell Taylor got his leaving certificate, but Russell was always a very good rememberer of whatever he read, he could recall that. And to this day, he's got a Master of Business Administration. He's been the primary person of, well, at the moment he's the head of the Aboriginal Housing Organisation. He has been the head of the Australian, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies Unit, which was basically an Aboriginal think tank come holder of records for them. And he's what I always point to as the cleverest fellow that I ever grew up with, because he's, to this day, he's still highly, he used to own the corner shop at Millers Point, the corner shop on Kent Street. It was a milk bar. And when he retired out of that, he decided that because of his Aboriginal heritage, he would like to go back to school and do something for, in inverted commas, his people, like the Aboriginal people. And not that he never said he wasn't an Aboriginal. He's very light-coloured. But he never sort of went out of his way. And now he's doing as much as he can in the hierarchy of his people's setups to try and get the stigma of Aboriginals wasting money. Because he's got all these qualifications, he can fine trim things, and that's why he's really sought up. I only found out the other day he's going to hand his job in as the state Aboriginal housing bloke, and he's going to Canberra again to live down there and to do something. I assume it's in the same, but on a federal level. Mm-hmm. So, but most of the people got their intermediate certificate. I myself didn't, but
didn't go as far as that, you mean?
I went for it, but I never got it. I was not a good school person. I was always the one that was playing up in class, and although I really did enjoy mathematics, history, and English. And it was the only thing I was interested in. The rest I didn't care about.
So what was your first job after leaving school?
My first job was selling papers all day at the corner of Carrington and Margaret Street in Sydney, at a place called Shell House. I worked for a bloke called Voisey, his name was. He owned the paper shop at Erskine Street in Sydney, and he had three all-day newspaper stands. And this was a fixed stand. It was a fold-up pair, like a sandwich board display. But the newspaper trucks used to come around and drop your papers. You'd tell them what you needed, what amount you needed. I used to sell up to 3,500 papers a day, women's weeklies, magazines and things like that. But also at the time, that was my first job. I wasn't quite 15 years old. And I sold newspapers on board ships, strangely enough, for the same newsagent of a Sunday, because seamen love getting a newspaper. They love keeping up to date with news. And they were very good tippers, seamen, as well. And then, because I was a big lad, he asked me, would I like to do this newspaper stand all day? And at the time, I was getting £18 a week, less, I think, a couple of quid tax. And my father was getting about 16 quid a week, or thereabouts, maybe £17 a week, working for the Maritime Services Board. So here I am, a 15-year-old kid, getting more than my father. And that was the first job I had. Then later on, I worked for the PMG delivering telegrams around the city. And having grown up in Millers Point, the Rocks and everywhere, I knew the city like the back of my hand. And it was quite a good job. You're on a push bike out in the elements all day, and it was good fun. But the paper job was not like it was going to be a lifetime thing, although I'd probably be a lot richer than I am today.
So after selling newspapers, did you get a more permanent job?
My grandmother got me an application form for the PMG, which was the Postmaster General, or the Post Office, and now Telstra, or whatever, I think it's still called the Post Office, but it was a government entity at the time, and I became a telegram boy, which was basically, it was called a junior postal officer. That was your designation. And you rode push bikes and delivered, hand-delivered telegrams. Also, at the time before the transmission of stuff that we've got today with computers, radio pictures used to come in from overseas, and they were like a wet fax machine. It's very hard to explain, but it was the photo was sent over in a coded electric pulse or whatever, and when they came in at the GPO, this could be anything like the assassination of Kennedy's photos or things like that. They came to the GPO and you had to get on the push bike and ride to up where Grace Brothers was, up at Broadway, past Central, to either Kibak's newspapers, which was the Mirror, or Sun Gravure, which was the Daily Sun. And you'd take them up there and then they'd put them, these were wet negatives, they still had the fixture and everything dripping off them. And you took that up there and then that was, of course, stop the presses and they'll put these pictures in the paper and that. I did that for about 15 months and then later on I worked for the railway for about a year. And I had a lot of jobs in between, pumping petrol and things like that. And then at one stage I'd worked for Goodyear Rubber at Bankstown, and I found that one day after being there I was the boss of the section. And I said to the fellow, why am I the boss of the section? They said, because you're going to be the only one that can speak English here. And he said, tomorrow there'll be a Qantas bus arrive here and you will see some of the biggest men you've ever seen, all Northern Italians. He said, and they'll come off and they'll all be wearing suits and everything, but they will work in the suits, these beautiful shot silk Italian suits, and very few of them could speak one word of English, and I just was pointing in sign language and that, but they were the new immigrants that were coming into Australia at the time. This was later when I was about almost, or going on to be 18 years old then, but after one day of that I thought, no, I can't be a boss and I can't not talk to people. And I rang up a friend of mine who was a merchant seaman, he was a deck boy, and I said, what have I got to do to go to sea? So I rang him up and he told me what the basics was, so I got a train in the city, just walked out of the factory, I said, good boy, keep me money, do whatever you like. And fortunately, in a freak set of circumstances, I actually done a chest x-ray, an eyesight test, a full medical in 2 days, passed all them. And then on the following Monday, there was a new system come into the Merchant Navy, which they could increase port quotas by bringing people in. And I was the first kid in the Sydney precinct to be taken in under this new system, and then I stayed at sea for 30 years. So I was a...
Really? So you were away a lot, were you?
I was really lucky. I got to have a look around just about everywhere you can go in Australia on a ship I've been. I was fortunate. I went to China in 1966, before China was barely being opened up to the outside world. After the, in actual fact, the week that we went over on a ship, it was called the R.W. Miller, and that was Miller's wash coals, also Miller's beer, and they bought these tankers over, and the oil companies wouldn't give them cargoes, and he said, "Well, I'll show you what I can do," and he got a wheat cargo, filled the oil tanker with wheat, sent it over to Shanghai, and we were over in Shanghai for a week. And then when we left Shanghai, the day after we left, and news all around the world, they pulled all the crews off the foreign ships there, put them in cages and marched them through the street. It was a very scary procedure. But fortunately, we'd left the day before, and because the Seamen's Union in Australia had looked after cheap crews on ships that were being downtrodden by overseas employers, we had a very good rapport with the people in China, because it was a socialist union, the Seamen's Union of Australia, or the heads were socialist. But when we got to China, the people over there bent over backwards to show us anything we wanted to see, anything we wanted to do. There was no restrictions on us, whereas everything else was kept in a box. You couldn't do anything. We were got open slather for everything. We could look wherever we want to, and do whatever we want to do, go wherever we want to. And fortunately, the ship's captain let us do that too. He said, "You're never going to get here again. Go and have a look at the place."
Yeah, this is during the Cultural Revolution, then, isn't it?
It was in February. March 1966. It was just after the decimal currency changeover. which was the 14th of February 1966. I don't remember the jingle.
Yes, and it all changed to dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very interesting. So you spent most of your life at sea then?
I spent 30 years at sea. I was classed as an able-bodied seaman. You do 12 months as a deck boy, then 2 years as an ordinary seaman, and then you automatically become an able-bodied seaman because you've learnt your trade. Although it was classed as an unskilled, you were classed as an unskilled labourer, or semi-skilled labourer, because you knew about splicing wire and making ships run and painting and steering them and whatever. But for 30 years, it was a very good life, and I enjoyed 99% of it. Towards the end, what happened was, because I was an able-bodied seaman, I worked up in the sunlight. I steered the ship, I kept lookout, maintained the daily maintenance of the ship and things like that, but I did it on deck. I never did any engine ram, and I never had a good rapport with engineers. And I thought, if I got to go, when the new system came, it was what they call multi-skilling, or you had to be an integrated rate and work down below and on deck as well. And I honestly didn't think I could work with the engineers, so I stayed untrained. I could have retrained and got a lot more money. And the retraining existed of 10 weeks next to the casino and Launceston, to the training school down there, where you only learnt what you knew anyway. But I never redone that, so the opportunities for work shrank steadily for me, to the point where I got the same job four times in a row. I said, if I get it a fifth time, I'm going to retire. So I had my home paid for and a bit of money in the bank, so I just retired, and I've been unemployed ever since, for the last 11 years.
Really? Now, let's talk a bit about the shops and the businesses around the point. Well, who was on the corner of Kent Street and Argyle Place, for instance?
Well, there was a chemist shop right on the corner, but next door there was what we used to call Marie and Tony's Milk Bar, which was later owned by Russell Taylor. It was a very small mixed built business, but mainly a milk bar. You could buy bread, and when the paper shop was Saturday, that was, you know, but you could get your milkshakes and your lollies and your ice creams there. The people that were in it were of Italian origin, very nice people. In actual fact, I, I met the lady, and she'd be well in her 80s about 2 years ago, and she was still alive then. Her husband had died previous. Next door to them, there was a dry cleaner shop, and then there was a fish and chip shop on the corner. There's a small lane, I don't know the name of it, next to the Captain Cook Hotel. This is the very beginning of Kent Street, and there was a fish and chip shop there. It was rough fish and chips, but it was tasty. There was, on the directly opposite the post office, on the corner of Argyle and Kent Street, there was what was called Charlie Conran's shop. And there was two shops. There was Charlie Conran's, which was a milk bar, and it was a place, the old style milk bar, tables, you could sit down and actually have a milkshake or an ice cream sundae or things like that. And next door there was a small general store, like for dry goods, and you could buy refrigerated cold meats and things there. That was called John Holly's. And then later, what happened, that house, those houses there, the foundation started sinking, and the doorstep, over the period of years, it went from having no doorstep to stepping down about 18 inches to go into the shop. And in the finish, they condemned the buildings. There's a small block of flats there now. But Charlie Conran never opened another shop. He left the area. He stood for the Liberal Party, which was like a snowflake's chance in hell in Millers Point, because it was just so devout Labor. And John Holly opened another little shop on the opposite side of the street. And John was a funny little man. He had a withered right arm, I think. I could be wrong. But he had a massive hand-driven slicing machine. And during the war, he was another fellow that tried to go to war to enlist, but he couldn't because of this infirmity that he had. But he always made sure that the men that were away fighting, when they came home on leave, because bacon was very hard to get and things like that, and he had a cool room of it over in Piermont Coal Stores. And he always made sure when the soldiers were home on leave that they always had eggs and bacon. So that was his part of the war effort. And John, for years, had that little shop there. And I don't know whatever became of him, but he was an institution. There was Reuben Lewis's barber shop, which was infamous because he sold condoms on display in the front window. During the war, apparently he made an absolute killing from the armed services, the Americans and whatever, because he had condoms. As children, we knew roughly what they were, and then later on, of course, we knew what they were. But Rube was, his name was Reuben Lewis, and I assume he was of Jewish origin. I could be wrong. He knew how to cut hair. One style was basically called a basin cut. Put the hand on your top, and he had a hand clippers and a pair of scissors, and the clippers were never ever sharp. They always pulled the hair on the back of your neck. But he basically trimmed to the top of your ears in a circle, looked like a he'd come out of a Franciscan order or something. And it really, really was a cruel haircut. There was another barber shop just up the road, and he was twice as expensive. It was Rube was threepence for a haircut or sixpence, I can't remember at the time. But the other fellow charged twice as much. So if your mum gave you money to go and get a haircut, say it was a shilling in the one barber and sixpence in Rube's, and you went to Rube Lewis's, you had sixpence to spend over. But when you got home, your mother knew where you got your haircut. You never went to the good barber, you know.
She could always tell.
Yeah, because the haircuts were so standardised. And there was a little butcher shop there. They called the Garrison Butchery too. But it was, I don't ever remember it working as a butchery until the 60s. I don't remember it. It was always there. Pardon me. And there was also what they called ham and beef shops. There was one opposite the Palisade Hotel, which was basically a sandwich shop for the wharfies. The wharfies had come up, put their order in for lunch, walk across the pub, have a couple of schooners of beer, because they used to get an hour for lunch, and then, because there was no counter lunch at the Palisade, pick their lunch up and eat it on the way back to the wharves. And the same with the other. There was quite a few little sandwich shops around there. There was a paper shop. Then later on, a laundromat, which is there today, but that was more modern. And there was a shop in Windmill Street, the corner of Windmill and Lower Ford Street. There was a Green Grocer's there, and a shop where you could buy drawers, dry sores, biscuits, and things like that. And that was basically there was one new office building opposite the Captain Cook Hotel. And it's a veterinary products dealership or something now, but I don't even know when that was built. But that was basically, and the only other businesses that were around, there was betting shops. Before, prior to the TAB, there was five illegal SP starting price betting shops around Millers Point. There was one in Windmill Street, which was the most frequented because he had a better setup than most. And at Christmas time, if you'd been gambling with him, depending on the rate of your gambling, there was always an envelope there for you at Christmas time. I can remember as a small child having strip and teach weigh a horse, which was a big bet at the time. But at Christmas time, you might get an envelope and there might be 10 shillings in there. And that was your rebate for your gambling with him for the rest of it. But the bigger gamblers, like the fathers and that, they might get £15, which was a lot of money. But by the same token, he won a lot more off during the year. But
and the pubs, were they pretty full? Or?
The pubs were, because it was a working class, I can, when we lived in Gloucester Street, there was a hotel up the lane from us, which was once again in the path of the Carl Expressway, called the Red Lion Hotel. And my father had these big green quart bottles, which were Reisha's bottles. You could actually buy them, a quart bottle with a wire top stopper in it. But the hotels would also refill them for you. So of a Thursday night, which was pay night for the Maritime, I used to go up to the pub with him. He'd buy me a small bottle of Blue Bow lemonade. There was only two soft drinks you could buy in the pub. Was Blue Bow lemonade, was probably a 200ml bottle, or this stuff was like an orange juice called Palato. I don't know why, but I suppose from pellet. I know, but Thursday night, that was my treat, and I had to take his big bottle of beer home for him, and Mum would have tea on the table when he got home from the pub. And then after we'd had tea, he'd take me down to the end of George Street to what used to be, it was where the Menzies Hotel and the concourse for Wynyard Railway Station is now, but that used to be the Wynyard Hotel. It was Wynyard something other hotel, but there was a newsreel there, and he used to take me into the newsreel. I'd buy a packet of Jaffas or whatever it was, a soft drink or something, and the fellow that looked after the newsreel, he'd leave me there for 2 hours because the newsreel went for 2 hours, which was the only way he had of getting pictures of overseas happenings at the time, like prior to television. But Dad'd go and have a drink with his mates at the pub there for 2 hours and come and pick me up and take me home. But that was the fortnightly treat or weekly, I think it was a weekly treat, and the thing. And the other hotels, like the Captain Cook Hotel, everyone had their own, but no one used to be exclusive to one hotel. They used to go and see them because they knew their mate would be at a pub at a different time, and it wasn't very far to walk, and there was so many hotels. And just, I think from my grandmother's place within a kilometre radius there was 27 hotels, and that's from on the hill from the observatory. And I can just, well, that extended up to where Caldick's house is, the Dunbarton Castle, down to the first and last at Circular Quay. And they all did good business. There was obviously a market for beer, which there still is.
That's the end of tape number MPFH42, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH42, side B. With all those pubs going, was there an alcoholic sort of problem around Millers Point?
Not so much that you'd notice. As I said, my father later in his life became a chronic alcoholic, whether that was war nerves or whatever. But the men done really physically hard work because the original, before they were called waterside workers or longshoremen as they are in America, they were called coal lumpers. And that was the coal lumpers union and became later the waterside workers union and then later the Maritime Union of Australia. Because coal used to be transported in Hessian bags, like what we call corn bags. So bloody big bags. I don't know how much weight was in them, but that was all done by hand, hence the need for those wharfies hooks that I talked about earlier. Most of the stuff was in bags of 100 pound or things like that. They were sheerly physical, working all day, so they probably enjoyed their drink of a night. I know there was families that had problem with alcoholism, with husbands beating wives, giving their kids a very hard time. But that was in the absolute minority. Most of the time, the people that drank were social drinkers, and very rarely of a Sunday, if you went to someone's house and you happened to be there when lunch was being served, if you were a kid, there was always another plate for you. But mum and dad would have a bottle of beer on the table of a Sunday. But I can't remember any big dramas from drink. I can remember seeing two well-known street fighters fight on the corner of Kent and Argyle Street, and they literally belted each other around for 20 minutes, stopped, went and had a couple of schooners, and went back and got into the fight again. And I mean, but these things happened. I've seen almost the full crew of a passenger ship called the Southern Cross come up and take the Lord Nelson Hotel to pieces because someone had belted one of the crew, one of the local fellows, a fellow called Johnny Bergen, who was known as Cuts and Bruises, because he always had cuts and bruises. He loved fighting, but he belted one of the crew, and anyway, the whole crew come up about. I was selling papers at the time. I may have been 12, and I could see them coming up, and I thought there's going to be big trouble here. So I went over and took the papers back to the paper shop and bolted up and said to me, "Uncle, come and watch this." And we were looking from the observatory hill down on the whole proceedings, and they virtually smashed all the windows in the pub, and anyone that was there copped a belting. It was basically like a mini riot, and then it was all over, and it was back to normal. Yeah. But that's a long time ago too. I'd say I was about 12 at the time, so that'd probably make it about 1960. But the ship's crews used to come up, and not so much drink at the point, because they weren't seamen's hotels. The seamen's hotels were, strangely enough, one called the Slip Inn, where the Danish princess now, that used to be called the Royal George. That's where she met her husband, in the Prince of Norway or whatever it is. It was
Denmark.
Yeah, Caroline, yeah. And then there was one up the road from there, and it was called the Welcome Inn, and it was a notorious seamen's pub, which used to lead onto the Hungry Mile, and it was known as the Bunch, and for want of swear words, because there was a bunch of bad buggers in there. But that was, the seamen never used to come up off the wharves to drink there. They go and drink at Piermont or anywhere else. But the locals, and the pubs, of course, were different hours. Some was an early opener, went from 6 till 6, and all the pubs used to shut at 6 o'clock at one stage, and then later they, of course, stayed open till 10 o'clock and to the hours now with a virtually 24-hour trading.
Mm. Yeah, sure. Were you a member of the union when you were at sea?
It was a catch-22 situation. To get to sea, you had to be a member of the union.
Just sit back.
To get to sea, you had to be a member of the union, and you couldn't be a member of the union unless you were already at sea. As I explained before, I was lucky. I was the first person to come on under this new system, so I automatically became a member of the union until I paid me dues, which was, I can't think, it was a couple of quid a quarter at the time, say maybe $4 a quarter. But you had to be a member of the Seamen's Union of Australia to work on Australian ships, and in my capacity, in my area on the ships, in the deck department or the engine room. The catering was the Cooks and Stewards Union, or Cooks Union and Stewards Union. The officers and the engineers had their own unions, but you had to be a member of the union. And the Seamen's Union of Australia was run by a fellow at the time, or the president was a fellow called Elliot Valance Elliot. He was an avowed socialist, had been a socialist in all his working life, and he basically transformed the Australian coast from being very hard conditions on ships to having decent living conditions, to have decent standards of food, decent wages and that. And I was always, and still am, a proud, well, when I was at sea, I was normally a union rep on the ship, the delegate and whatever, and I dealt with the shipping companies or the captain or whoever it was that I had to deal with. But it was a big part of my life being a trade unionist, as were most of the people in Millers Point. The men were very proud of their unionism. I mean, May Day March, the first six rows, it'll be from Millers Point and Balmain and Piermont, because they were always proud to be unionist and proud to be part of the fight to get better conditions for their industry. as I said, and the ladies, there was always, the Seamen's Union always had a women's auxiliary. In every state in Australia, in Brisbane, they actually used to bring you down sandwiches and it on a Monday morning to the pickup where we used to go for our jobs, because they knew that most of the seamen had been drunk all weekend and I wouldn't have had much to eat, so they made sure they fed you on Monday morning.
Right. Good. Were there any strikes ever that you were involved with?
I'd been on individual ships where we'd were trying to get a condition, whether it be safety issue, wages, or part of the overall union applying for thing. I was never involved in any big strike, with the exception of what was called the engineer strike, and that was the engineers, the only time they ever actually went on strike, which was really surprising, because they used to sit back and wait till everyone else had lost wages through going on strike and then just get the conditions that flowed through. They'd say, they've got them, we want them. But that's but the Seamen's Union, there was day strikes here and there, but usually, because at the time the union had a lot of power, these days the employers have the power, and it's like everything, the wheel turns, everyone gets a turn. But it was very good part of my upbringing, was the fact that it was like being from the point you knew the rules, you knew that you had to be part of the union and you had to produce for the union. You didn't want to let the union down in your work, whether it was being a waterside worker, a painter and docker, or a merchant seaman. It was just, there was a bit of pride in being a trade unionist, and plus the fact that the union was one of the strongest there was in Australia at the time.
Now, there were plans afoot to change Millers Point from a maritime precinct to more of a residential precinct. The Patrick's Wharves are going to be vacated very, very soon. How do you feel about all that?
It's a shame, but everything's static. I find that when I revisit Millers Point now, there's only possibly three or four people that I grew up with that are still residents there. I find that the people that have come into Millers Point, a lot of people through their circumstances are not as well off, and it has reverted to being a slum. What they'll do with the wharves, with the Patrick's Wharves and everything, is probably build million-dollar condominiums and whatever, because of the water views and everything. But Millers Point itself, it has, in the last 15 years, started to go back to what it was when I was a kid. It was a place to be avoided because it wasn't very nice. Today you can go down what used to be called the night soil lanes or whatever, and you'll find empty syringes. The people that are, because of their circumstance in life, of addicted to drugs or whatever, but when they use the needle, just throw them out in the back lane. There's actually a mob called the Needle Stick Group for they come around and pick up the syringes so the kids can't play with them. The place never, when we were young there, the council always had the place spotlessly clean. You can go down there now, there's a lot of garbage laying around, and it's because of the restrictions of finances, I suppose, with the council, that they don't do it as often as they used to. They haven't got the workforce that they used to. The contractors aren't as conscientious as what the council employees used to be. As I said, I don't know if building condominiums on the wharves or everything improves it or not, because the people that come there are not working class, but they're not, they may be workers as such, but they're not workers that are working on those wharves where their houses are now. They're not the workers that were blacksmiths or coopers or whatever they were in those times gone by. They're more an elite because of the price of things. They're either highly skilled and highly educated people, and that has gone out of the area. When I'm not saying that it was dumb when I was a kid or people weren't educated, but now it's a different class of people that have moved into the area. And you've got both extremes. With the new home units and condominiums, these are the wealthier part of our civilization, and you've still got single mothers and drug addicts living in what used to be Maritime Services Board accommodation. So you're getting a vast extreme between the two. By the same token, it was still a lovely place to grow up.
Would you like to live at Millers Point again if you could?
I would move back there tomorrow, even though it's not the same as what it was. If I could go back to the old house or any of the houses on Millers Point, I would do if I could afford to do it. There's no, because the memories of growing up there are still good memories, and there's still people that I can visit in Sydney around there and go to different places for a beer or to see organisations like the Seamen's Union and people like that. It's still there. I would move back tomorrow if I could. And I've always said that. There's such a good bond between, and I think most of the people that I know would say exactly what I've just said. It wouldn't be the same and everything, but I think a lot of people would like to go back there, only because it was central, everything, and the memories was just such good memories there.
It's nice to have those memories.
It is. It's. I mean, in amongst all the stuff that goes on in the world today with terrorism and everything in the world, you can go back to a quieter, more peaceful time when people genuinely thought well of their neighbours and looked after their neighbours. And that's something that's always in there, you know. I like to think that these places could come again, but whether or not they ever will or not, it's gone too urban or whatever. And plus, as I said, the situation's changed. We're talking 50 years ago. 50 years is a vast span in one's life, you know.
I don't think you could bring those times back, actually. The life's progressed too far.
And the innocence is gone. Because now, I mean, I know of cases where people have answered a knock at the door and someone's been standing there with a knife at Millers Point saying, give us what you've got. And it's because they were junkies or drug addicts or just were thieves. But that's happened in the last 2 years. People that I know have told me about that. Things that would never, ever be thought of happening years ago. But this is not a Millers Point phenomenon. I think this is a world phenomenon. It's just that we've grown old too hard.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll seem to be coming a bit towards the end of our interview. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
This is really great that someone's decided to put the remembrances or the reminiscences or whatever. And as I said, and the majority of people will have their own story to tell, as mine is. And I've really enjoyed doing it, to tell you the truth. And
we've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed hearing you very much.
It's nice to think that somewhere in the future, whether it's 50 years or now from now, which will make 100 years from the time I grew up there, someone will be able to say, well, gee, that bloke enjoyed his life growing up in that environment, whether it's spaceships and whatever or whatever. That's all there and it can't be changed. Now, it's going to be there for a long time. And for reference reasons, what I've told you today may be able to be correlated with other people's reminiscences and get a really good overview of the place. And as I said, it's really great.
And you've only spent like 8 years at Millers Point, wasn't it?
Yeah, only eight. But as I said, I never was away from it longer than I had to be. I could never get back there quick enough to, as I said, because the fun and the people that my original friends from the time when I can first remember things, those friends are still my friends today. Because we had a bond of growing up in that area, and I think that's the reason. We may have grown up somewhere else, but we still wouldn't have the bond. I know that today I will, a merchant seaman for all I know is getting buried today, sometime this morning, but there will be a lot of people that I know from the merchant seaman side and from Millers Point as well will be at the after party after the, well, the wake after the funeral, and I'll see people there that I probably haven't seen for a long time. But still, they're still going to be me friends because we were friends when we were kids. That's the thing.
Would you go as far as to say that you are what you are because of Millers Point?
I think so. I think so. I think the in the Australian vernacular of being fair dinkum, that my priorities in life are that I will try and help anyone that I possibly can until they kick me in the teeth or like, but I mean, I think the grounding that you got of being A, compassionate, and the fact that you had a respect for property and things like that, that was all ground in from that original Millers Point creed, I suppose, And that was the thing, that you did things the right way and you never stole from working people and things like, just that's the thing, that you look after people of your own class. Yeah, that's the best thing, the best way I can put it.
That's great, Russell. Thanks very much for the interview.
No, it's good. It's
and really... on behalf of our sponsors, we'd like to thank you as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is then the end of the interview with Russell Fitchett, and the end of tape number MPFH 42, side B.